Ed Ussett, who I'm going to turn this over to in just a minute, has a real wealth of experience in grain marketing. And on both sides of the marketing issue, selling, buying, and more recently, as an exceptional marketing educator, the Winning the Game series. I don't know, Ed, is that what? Have you? How many participants have you had? The last number I heard was over 18,000.
Well, it just keeps getting bigger,
now.
John. We quit counting, but we still do them, and they're still popular.
And folks learn things. So, presently, with the Center for Farm Financial Management out of the University of Minnesota, I would also point out that if you go out and Google Ed, you'll probably find his blog, which has some exceptional information as well on marketing that you can follow up with. So, without further ado, Ed, it's yours.
Thank you, John, and good morning to everyone, or I should say good afternoon to those of you from the East Coast on Eastern Daylight Time. As John said, my name is Ed Ussett. I'm a grain marketing specialist with the University of Minnesota, and I'm going to spend about 20 minutes talking about marketing and grain marketing. There are a few links up here. John noted my blog. I also want to note I've got a book out there that you can find through our website. I'm also a columnist for the Corn and Soybean Digest, and you can find my work there also. This morning, I want to talk and just touch very briefly on two aspects of marketing: pre-harvest and post-harvest marketing. I'm a big believer that marketing should be cut into these two halves, and they present two different challenges, and we take a different mindset to each half. I like to think that my approach to pre-harvest marketing is very strategic, forward-looking, sort of big picture stuff. Post-harvest marketing is a very nuts and bolts tactical approach where I'm responding to what the market is telling me at any given time. And we're going to touch on both of them. But before we get there, let me step back a moment. John noted that there have been some very good outlooks presented in this as part of this Ag and Uncertain Times webinar series. And that's wonderful. I think we should be up to speed on the drivers of supply and demand and other issues that are affecting grain and livestock and dairy prices. But that said, you're going to hear very little about outlook from me, and yet I'm going to get very specific with marketing plans for this year's crop and the year ahead. And I'm going to do that because I've got a little different approach to marketing. I like to note that I'm always trying to ask the question, what would I do, what actions would I take in pricing grain if I had no idea where prices were going? And of course, I don't have any idea where prices are going, so it's a relevant question. So I want you to think about that as I show you my approach to marketing. I'm trying to find a dime. I'm trying to find an advantage in marketing. And the way I'm going to find that advantage, that good average price, I'm going to have a plan, and within those plans is my desire to eliminate marketing mistakes. This is some data from I steal from my friends at Iowa State University. They've got a model farm, and they'll note that over decades that the average farm earns on average 20 to 30 cents per bushel. Now, that has held true for a number of years. Individual years may be much better or much worse, but the long-term average of 20 to 30 cents, I'm told, is quite consistent. Now, I look at that number and I tell myself, man, if I can find just a dime in marketing, just a little bit of improvement, I can have a big impact on my bottom line. And if finding the dime does not sound ambitious enough, you get the idea. You don't have to stop at a dime. You can look for three or four. I tell people to have a plan, and I'm going to show you some plans today. But if we're going to have a plan, I better give you my definition of a marketing plan, which is a proactive strategy to price your grain that considers your financial goals, cash flow needs, price objectives, blah, 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 a whole list of things. The operative word here, it's a proactive strategy. It's not reactive. It's not selling grain because I happen to need cash today. It's not overactive. I'm not a proponent of rebuying and reselling and rebuying and reselling with the overuse of option strategies. I want to be proactive. I'm looking to eliminate mistakes in my marketing. In fact, the first chapter of my book is titled Five Common Mistakes in Grain Marketing. And I'm of the belief that if we just quit messing up, if we just quit shooting ourselves in the foot, that alone will make us better at the job of marketing. I even go so far as to say that great marketing is really not about finding the highest price. I use a different definition for great marketing. To me, it's the individual, the producer, who can find an extra 10 to 20 cents or more per bushel with a solid plan that avoids mistakes. Well, let's talk pre-harvest marketing first for a few minutes. Two points I'd like to make. First of all, in this strategic approach, my production costs establish a minimum price objective in a marketing plan. And I also want to show off some seasonal price patterns that are of interest before harvest. We'll start with production costs first. I'm always asking producers, challenging them to know their production costs, because in my mind, in pre-harvest marketing, production costs establish a minimum price objective, and I also ask producers to focus on local production costs, the competitive environment in your area, and not your particular costs, which can be out of whack for a number of reasons. We have a wonderful resource at the University of Minnesota called FinBin. Has actual farm production data, financial data for real farms. There are a number of participating states in there, but your state may not be participating. I would suggest to you go to your own state ag economist, the extension service there. It's quite possible they've got the type of resources you need to understand production costs in your state and your area. I want to show you some interesting seasonal price patterns before harvest that make pre-harvest pricing of great interest to me. This is some information on December corn futures, the new crop contract on December corn in Chicago since 1990. We've got 19 years of data here. And what I'm doing is I'm taking a picture of December corn on May 1 in the middle of spring, and the second picture, also the start of planting, a second snapshot taken on October 1, and we'll call that the start of harvest. 5 months apart. Where was the price on May 1? Where was it on October 1st? And what you're going to see here is the change in the far right column notes a lot of red numbers. In fact, since 1990, 4 out of 5 years, the market has gone lower from spring to fall. And in fact, when we add in this year, we'll have a nice even 16 out of 20 years. It'll be the 7th year in a row that December corn has declined from the springtime to harvest. That's an interest to me in pre-harvest marketing. This is the same trend in a picture, if you will, average December corn futures over the last 20 years. I'm telling people I've got to have a pre-harvest marketing plan. I want to be ready to price something in the spring, but remember your minimum price. I won't price at any price. Show me an opportunity above my production costs. This is the same snapshot for soybeans over the same time period, looking at November new crop contract from May 1 to October 1, nearly 7 out of 10 years have declined from spring to fall. And when this year is done, most likely it will be 14 out of 20 years. Again, in a picture, I think we have to sit up and pay attention for early sales with soybeans, but don't forget that minimum price. I'll make a point on this minimum price. This is looking at November soybean futures since 2000. And you'll note that 5 years have gone down, 4 years up, and it doesn't look that impressive. But you know, if you take a couple of years out where prices were below production costs, and I would not have been interested in selling, and by the way, I was talking about this in 2001 and 2002. You remove those 2 years and you note that, well, 5 out of 7 years have declined. It's not 100%, but it's strong enough to have my interest in early sales. Spring wheat, same sort of pattern. Again, it's a 60-40 split, and that doesn't look too overwhelming in terms of evidence. But again, if you cut out these low-priced years, you see that again, nearly 3 out of 4 years have declined since 1990. Well, I'll introduce you to one of my celebrity producers. I like using a number of celebrity producers to illustrate my marketing approach. And Terry Timer is someone who makes harvest sales, pre-harvest sales in the spring, using, for example, a hedge to arrive contract or selling futures directly. To be specific, Terry makes sales in March, April, and May. Not on May 1. She makes one in March, one in April, one in May. She spreads it out. We're going to compare her results to a guy by the name of Barney Binless. Now, Barney is my friend who has no interest in pricing grain before harvest. He sells everything off the combine, taking the harvest price. So what we're doing is we're comparing these early sales by Terry to the harvest price as represented by Barney Binless. Well, here we are. I've been tracking these since 1990, and this is Terry's results versus the harvest price for corn, soybeans, and hard red spring wheat. You see a 20-cent advantage over the price over the harvest price for Terry and corn, nearly a 30-cent advantage in soybeans, just over 10-cent advantage in spring wheat. And note, though, on the far right, how often Terry was worse than Barney. It happens. I'm not suggesting to you that early sales are always better than the harvest price, and that explains the second half of the title of my book, the title being Grain Marketing is Simple, but then with the asterisk noting that it's just not easy, and the not easy part is nothing is 100%. What do we note about Terry? That over time, early sales paid off versus the harvest price. Her results are consistent for corn, soybeans, and wheat, but her decision to sell early does not work every time. Nothing is 100%. I show you my pre-harvest marketing plan for corn and soybeans and spring wheat. This is for 2010. This is based on production costs, if you will, in southern Minnesota. We have listeners from all around the country. This plan, I think, needs to be adapted for your local situation, your, you know, eastern or western part of the Corn Belt, wherever you are located there. And they can be found on my website also. You can print them out and take a look at it. One disappointing thing I've come to note here late now that as the new crop is, the harvest is looming. We're just weeks away in this late year. It's come to my, I've learned talking to people and reading a lot of different things that a whole lot of people didn't do much pre-harvest selling this year, that the lesson from the last 2 years is early sales are no good, and I would disagree with that. I would say that early sales can sometimes be too early and too cheap, as they were a couple years ago, but in down markets, you're going to be thankful for that. And it's disappointing that not much pre-harvest selling has been done. So I show you my 2010 marketing plans, which I posted on my website in June, and in fact have suggested a couple of early sales already. And I would challenge all the listeners here to, if you don't have a plan, why not? And why not take a look at mine and see how that might work for you? Okay, let's shift gears to the second half of marketing. Let's talk about post-harvest marketing and this issue that's just weeks away now throughout the Corn Belt, which is, should I store this grain or not, with a little bit of chat about carrying charges. Well, I think post-harvest marketing is really simple. Come harvest, you've got three basic choices in front of you. One is to sell grain at harvest. Another is to hold that grain in storage to sell later. A third is to hold grain in storage and sell the carry. I'll explain that in a moment. Excuse me, I'm having a little trouble here. How do I make that choice? Well, I'm going to introduce you to another celebrity producer of mine. This is Earl Etherore. And Earl is a guy who makes a choice based on carrying charges. If a large carry is offered, he sells the carry. If the carry is small or inverted in the market, he takes a risk with unpriced grain in storage. He has three tools to sell this carry, and I'll explain this in a moment. He can use a forward contract when there's a good basis. He can use a hedge to a rod contract, or he can sell futures directly through a broker when the basis is poor and offers you maximum flexibility. Now, this is a picture of carrying charges in the market, in the corn market, roughly about a week ago from September 9. The market is 20, 25 cents higher today, and yet the carry, the spreads from December to March to May and July are virtually identical today. I teach a course on futures and options at the University of Minnesota, and I tell my students on the first day of class that the single most important concept that they need to wrap their mind around to understand the nature of grain markets is the concept of carrying charges and what they tell us about a market. Large carrying charges, where you, such as the corn market right now, where the March, the May, the July are at a premium to the nearby contract like that. This is what we get when free supplies are large, when we have a big crop. And this is a market that is laying out the incentive to store grain at harvest and sell that premium for future delivery. You can earn a return to storage. You can wait for the basis to get better. You can defer your tax issues into the next year. You can hedge yourself against lower prices. That's selling the carry. Now, the spring wheat market and the soft wheat market and the hard wheat market in Kansas City are all also sporting large carrying charges like the corn market. The soybean market is not. It's a different story. The soybean market is flat. That's a very tiny carry. In fact, a month ago, the soybean market was what we call inverted. The nearby contracts were lower, was higher than the deferred. It does not make sense to store grain today and use some pricing tools to price grain tomorrow if it's not at a premium. So here's what Earl does. When he has on-farm storage, he has it. After harvest, he'll sell the carry when carrying charges are large. That is, the market's telling them we've got ample supplies, and we'll reward you for storing grain and selling that carry. But if the carrying charge is small, and small carries or inverses are the result of a tighter supply and demand situation, Earl says, well, what the heck? I'll take a chance on holding grain in the bin, unpriced, and I'll sell it in the spring. Based on Earl's approach at the Center for Farm Financial Management, we've developed this decision tree for sizing up the market, and you'll see that Earl's decision concerning carrying charges, whether they are large or small, is really the premier question we ask in this tactical approach to post-harvest marketing. It's not the only question we ask, but it is the first and most important question I want to know at harvest. Is the market offering me a large carry or a small carry? So, here's Earl. He bases his choice on carrying charges. Does that choice work? We're going to compare Earl to Barney Binless. You've met Barney, but I'll remind you that Barney has no on-farm storage, as his name suggests. So he's going to sell his crop off the combine, taking the harvest price each year. Well, here's Earl versus Barney over a 20-year period for corn, soybeans, and spring wheat. I want to note that I'm using real numbers from southwestern Minnesota. And please don't let that scare you away. I would suggest that any area in the northern two-thirds of the Corn Belt enjoys the same seasonal patterns in corn and soybeans and wheat. And these conclusions apply to virtually the entire Corn Belt. Notice that Earl found a 17-cent advantage in corn, and he sold the carry in 15 of 20 years. He was worse than Barney, 2 of 20 years. In soybeans, he never sold the carry. Carrying charges, large carrying charges, are a pretty rare event in the soybean market. And in spring wheat, Earl found a 10-cent advantage in making this simple choice. Now, I want you to understand something in my numbers. Earl's figures, Earl's results, are net of on-farm storage costs. I'm not allowing Earl to store grain for free. When he stores grain on-farm, I'm charging him an in-and-out handling fee of 8 cents a bushel on corn, 11 cents on soybeans. I am also charging him interest on his money, and that is calculated at 1% over the prime rate, whatever it was during each year. So these figures are not ignoring storage costs. They're not full costs. They're not commercial storage costs, but they are variable on-farm costs. So what do we conclude from this, comparing Earl versus Barney? That over time, Earl's choice, based on carrying charges, versus the harvest price, his choice paid off versus Barney's harvest price, net of on-farm storage costs. Again, like Terry, his results were consistent for corn, soybeans, and wheat. And it is healthy to remind ourselves that Earl's choice does not work every time. There are exceptional years in there, and they're not that rare. When Earl makes that choice and the market tone changes, and he can ask what it could have, should have. Well, what does this spell for my post-harvest marketing plans this year? I'll tell you what I'm thinking about. I always ask what Earl would do, and I've already told you that in corn and in spring wheat, there are some very large carrying charges out there, and Earl would sell that carry. And that's what I'm going to do in those markets. In the case of soybeans, carrying charges are flat. we've got a good basis, at least up in the upper Midwest, for soybeans. Best basis we've seen in a handful of years. Earl, based on his simple choice, would store soybeans and wait until the spring to see if prices get better. Here's where my appetite for risk and your appetite for risk must enter in. I'm looking at a pretty good price for soybeans at harvest still. I've had some good pre-harvest sales. I'm wondering if Barney doesn't have the right idea this year. In other words, Earl would hold unpriced soybeans for sale later in the year, and I'm quickly concluding, not me. My approach this year, I will write a post-harvest plan and post it on my website in about a month, but I'm leaning towards simply selling my beans at harvest and saving that storage space for corn or other commodities. What I've outlined for you here is sort of my proactive approach to grain marketing. I call it a proactive approach. This proactive approach is not bulletproof. It's not perfect. And you know what the weak side of this approach is? The Achilles heel in a proactive approach is what we call a bull market. And in a bull market, your sales are going to end up looking too early and too cheap in hindsight. That's the way I felt 2 years ago as the market screamed higher. I was the one who sold early and too cheap. But the good news is there are, in fact, three market types. There are bull markets, there are bear markets, and there are trading range or sideways markets. And the good news about this proactive approach is that it works very well in the other two types of markets, as evidenced by the fact that I've got pre-harvest sales that are well over a dollar above the current corn market. I think close to $2 above, a dollar above the soybean market, and I'm almost embarrassed to say $4 above the wheat market. Some final thoughts, and I'll turn it back to John. At harvest, at this time, the question I ask, are carrying charges large or small? And that's asking, what would Earl do? In the case of corn and wheat, carrying charges are large this year. In the case of soybeans, they're small. Early sales before harvest make Terry a winner over time. Not every time, but over time. And Terry and Earl are taking a proactive approach to marketing. John, I've said my piece, and I'm willing to throw it back to you.
Ed, thank you very much. And we have some questions in. I guess one of the first ones in, someone was asking if the definition of carry charge is the difference between futures and local cash price.
No, the difference between futures and local prices is what we'd call your basis. The carrying charges refer to the difference between different futures delivery months, the price of different months. So, for example, November soybeans and March soybeans, or March wheat and September wheat. They do relate together, but specifically carrying charges refers to different delivery months.
Okay, I'm going to have another question or two for you. If we could bring the pulling pods on while I ask these and begin to transition to to get Dylan's questions up, but don't go away yet, Ed.
Okay.
One of the questions about the cost of storage is whether or not you should also factor in insurance, quality losses due to mold, vermin, other kinds of things also in terms of the cost of storage.
Well, I think in terms of the 8-cent charge I'm using on corn and 11 cents on soybeans, these are figures from North Dakota State University, and I believe they include a modest amount for insurance. Vermin, grain going out of condition. No, it does not apply to that. I'm a very the producers in Minnesota are very fortunate, and in fact in the Northern Plains in general, we have a wonderful vermin and insect control situation. It's called winter, and that helps us keep grain in good condition for a long time. But the question is a good one, particularly if you're from a southern state, and you do need to factor that in.
And one last question before we begin to shift to Dylan. This question is, if the carrying charge is high, would you still use options and purchase a call when you sell?
You know, John, it's a good question, and in fact, my latest column in Corn and Soybean Digest will talk about this a little bit, this re-ownership strategy. I'm not a great lover of re-ownership strategies. Options are a lot like insurance, and we can look back over the last few years and think of some times when I sure wish I'd bought a few. And yet I would say to you that as a buyer of auto insurance and homeowners insurance and all these good things, I fully assume that I'll put more into that system than I take out of it over time. And I think the same is true with options. I'm not going to say never to them, but I'm underwhelmed by what options can do for me, and I know I stand alone in saying that. There are a lot of people just consider them the cure-all for many problems. I'm not saying never. Here's the crux of my challenge with options. A proactive approach to marketing is forward-looking. I'm looking forward. I'm not talking about last year's crop. Re-ownership strategies are buying something back that I've already sold, and to me that looks backwards. And it doesn't feel right to me. So I'll never say never to the use of options, but I think they're overplayed in terms of what they can bring to the party.
Thank you, Ed. And hang around, and I think when Dylan is finished, and we'll have a chance to have a little interaction with questions to the two of you. We'll have some questions specific for Dylan, but.